This podcast is brought to you by Local Silver Mint in Ware, New Hampshire. For the best selection of silver and gold, visit the Local Silver Mint showroom in tax-free New Hampshire today. Online at localsilvermint.com.
Sugar, spice, and everything nice. These were the ingredients chosen to create
The Grace Curley Show. Radio, TV, print, Grace Curley does it all.
She sings, she dances, she acts.
I'm waiting by the door for my Pulitzer.
She sounds hideous.
She's just the worst.
Yeah, she's a wacko.
She is the devil. I'm in hell.
Now, here's the millennial with the mic.
She still leaves me both breathless and speechless.
I love her.
She is the best.
Somebody will ask you to say Grace.
Grace Curley.
Grace!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Grace Curley Show. Thank you so much for joining us today. It is Cinco de Mayo. It is May 5th. Enjoy yourself. A margarita! Or two, if you so choose. Taylor, what's your favorite Mexican dish?
Dish? Ooh.
Yeah. You like a tacos guy, nachos?
Nachos are good. There was like an enchilada mole enchilada that I like at this one place in my area that they don't have anymore, but it was damn good.
Yes, well, happy Cinco de Mayo. I know this is one of Trump's favorite days.
The best taco bowls are at Trump Tower.
Yeah, I think it's a 10-year anniversary of that tweet that broke the internet. One of many tweets that eventually led to Donald Trump being tossed off Twitter, which was applauded, by the way, by all of these free speech full comedians. That was one of the moments that propelled people into Trump derangement syndrome. Like, we didn't realize at the time that all of these things were building up to TDS and that people were going to break because of it. People were going to lose all sense of themselves, all sense of their priorities, of their political philosophies because of this man. But that was one of the stepping stones to where we are today, is that Taco Bowl tweet. So if you're, you know, if you feel like celebrating today, you don't know how, look that up. Look that up while you sip your margarita, salt on the rim. Have your margarita and enjoy. We have a big, big, big show today. Yeah, Chris Van Hollen, by the way, I would suggest to Chris Van Hollen and some of these other Democrats, if you're going to have a margarita today with one of your heroes on the left, this is what they like to do. They sit down, they have these fireside chats, these beer summits, and they try to make heads or tails of what's going on today. Forget Kilmer Abrego-Garcia, okay? He's yesterday's news. Sit down with the White House Correspondents Association shooter and talk to him about the conditions that he's in. Because according to the judge who felt the need to apologize, we don't understand how bad this guy has it. You don't have a right to sing the blues unless you're the guy who just tried to kill, the last guy who just tried to kill the president. There's been so many of them. But I think he's the one who deserves a margarita, because alligator Alcatraz and those ham sandwiches, that sounded bad, but it's just, you know, there's always victims. The only person who never gets to play the victim card is Donald Trump, but the people who try to shoot him, they get to play it quite a bit. People who hate America, they get to play it quite a bit.
Everybody's always blaming me for everything.
The people who are screaming at Jewish kids as they walk around on a school campus, they get to play the victim card. Everyone gets to play it, except for the man who keeps dodging bullets left and right. And we will talk about this as the show goes on, because what a just an absurd example of these woke judges who have completely lost the plot. And everything's flipped on its head. I've talked about that with Joe Abraham, the angel dad, before. Everything's flipped on its head. The people who should be getting sympathy, the people who should be treated with respect and listened to, and whose stories we should care about, and who have been so hurt by the Biden administration and by Democrat policies writ large, those people, become the enemy and get pushed aside and are dismissed and are kind of like second-class citizens. And the people who are inflicting pain and inflicting division and inflicting violence on this country that they hate so much, those are the people that the left runs to and clings to and tries to bolster up and give public profiles to. And then they wonder why no one can stand them. Then they wonder why it doesn't matter. They wonder why these celebrities like Beyonce and $1 billion of fundraising and all this good coverage from the media still can't salvage their reputations. It's because we see this upside down world that you're creating and we don't like it. We don't like it one bit. We have City Councilor Ed Flynn joining us at 105. He's going to talk about a recent break-in. I don't know if people... This is a story that we've seen more and more of, and I oftentimes read about it happening in the South End because it's so close to Mass and Cass. But in this case, we're talking Beacon Hill, because on Myrtle Street, there was a crack-fueled break-in. So a crack-fueled crazy man was found. The father of the house found him on the family toilet. Or, I'm sorry, on the toilet and took him to the family toilet. Do you differentiate? This is the family toilet. But he found him there, and he locked his kids up in their room and called the police. And this is just something that you're hearing a lot more about now, which is just homeless, violent criminals breaking into people's houses and setting up shop. And so Ed Flynn's going to come on to talk about this, because he's calling on these city officials to hold these criminals, these drug addicts who are breaking into people's homes, accountable, and to not keep allowing Boston to be a revolving door for this kind of behavior. And also, we're going to talk a lot about the veterans with Ed Flynn, because when I was messaging back and forth with him, he actually asked me, he said, could we also talk about veterans? Because it's an issue that's very important to him. I know it's very important to a lot of our listeners. And he wanted me to know that the City of Boston Veterans Department budget submitted by Mayor Wu to the council was cut by 14%. And he wrote, totally unacceptable. I happen to agree. So we will discuss that at the 1 o'clock as well. Now, other things that are going on today, because I got to zoom out here and keep you abreast of everything happening. Marco Rubio will be at the press podium today, filling in. He's the first fill-in for Caroline Leavitt, Trump's press secretary, who is on maternity leave. I don't know, Taylor, do we have word yet if she's had her baby girl, or we're still waiting?
I have not seen anything.
I know that over the weekend there was like a fake news story going around. It was AI. It wasn't AI. It was just a picture of her with her first baby that was being recirculated, and people were like, congrats, this is Caroline and her baby girl. And then other people were saying, this is not real. And everyone keeps falling for this stuff, myself included. It's like, we gotta be a little bit more discerning about these posts. But anyway, Caroline's out on maternity leave, which she absolutely should be. There's been so much chaos at this White House, between the White House Correspondents Association dinner. She was obviously at the dais for that. And she just works her ass off. And so I'm glad that she's probably with her family, maybe back in New Hampshire, getting ready for the arrival of her baby girl. But it is funny to me that the first guy they tap to kind of fill in on this rotating panel of press secretaries is the guy with 1 million jobs. They're like, who can we bring in here who doesn't have enough going on?
Wasn't he already named CEO of Spirit Airlines?
Yeah, he is. He's overseeing the graveyard of planes right now as we speak. The man, and he DJ'd over the weekend. I talked about that briefly yesterday, Taylor. Did you see him on the ones and twos?
I didn't see it, no.
It was so awesome. The funny thing about him is he always looks so serious. He always looks so serious, and every time I hear someone from this White House do an interview where they're asked who is the funniest person in the cabinet, they always say Marco. But you would not really gather that, because he's really deadpan and it seems to have a dry sense of humor. So he's going to be at the White House today. I think Marco's awesome. I was talking to the mailroom manager about this. People in Florida really love him. I think that people in Trump world really love him, and he's going to be at the podium. Could not come at a better time, because I think he's someone who is able to send a clear message as to what our mission is right now in Iran. And I think that's something that has been faltering as of the last few weeks, and people are starting to lose sight of what we're doing there. And also, one other thing I want to say on Marco before I talk about Iran is that he's also set to meet with Pope Leo this week. So just another, this guy.
Is that a job interview too?
I know. I'm like, oh no. Oh no. Are they going to give him a job at the Vatican? Hey, Marco, we really need a, we really need someone here to keep us on track. He can't take on anymore. He cannot take on anymore. But he will be meeting with Pope Leo, the man of a thousand jobs, Marco Rubio. And meanwhile, though, to pivot back here to what I wanted to start with, and we're going to talk to Francis Martel at 12:30 about this topic. That would be the conflict in Iran. So this morning I watched Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, along with General Kane, give a briefing from the Pentagon. And it does seem like something is imminent, both because there's, I think there's kind of, it's twofold here. We have the indiscriminate drone strikes from Iran. So they hit UAE, I believe it was like a key oil facility that they hit, but also because of this newly announced Project Freedom, which started yesterday morning, and which is the administration's attempt to open the Strait of Hormuz to countries, to other countries, you know, to basically everyone but Iran, with guided missile destroyers and around 15,000 service members. Now, because of the strikes, and Taylor, we hit on this yesterday, and it got me thinking. This is oftentimes what happens. I'll have a conversation with Taylor, and then afterwards, I'm like, I wish we had expanded on that. We talked yesterday about Trump's recent Truth Socials that have been building over the last few weeks about blowing Iran off the face of the earth. He just put one of those out, I think it was Sunday or Monday. I actually think it was yesterday, on Truth Social, these warnings. And why he's doing this if there's not a willingness to make good on these warnings, which we know in other ways or in other situations he has made good on these threats. He's not all talk. But as of late, it does feel like there's just been one after the other and then nothing really comes from it. And there's a feeling that, okay, Iran keeps breaking the ceasefire. Like, I don't even see the point of calling it a ceasefire anymore. They've broken it so many times. So why aren't we doing anything in response? And also, and Dana Perino threw this out there this morning, and I thought it was a smart way to phrase it. It's like, when does restraint or holding back or, you know, just employing a little bit of caution and having patience, strategic patience for this regime, when does that start looking like a lack of resolve or, you know, an unwillingness to make good on these threats, so many of which are put out from the president's social media? And after listening to General Kane today talking about how we have thus far, in spite of the fact that they have broken the ceasefire, we are avoiding combat operations as of right now. I think the way he phrased it was they have not met the threshold of what Trump believes should restart combat operations. I was watching General Kane, I was watching Pete Hegseth, and I started to, I think, understand or get a clearer picture of the logic behind our current posture and our current strategic position. And I'm gonna break here, and we're gonna talk about it. Like I said, Francis Martel is coming on, but really what I think it boils down to is the Strait of Hormuz, if you can unlock that, if you can find the key and unlock that enigma, which is getting this thing open and running and the price of oil down and these ships in and out without danger of Iranian drones or missiles or kamikaze dolphins or whatever they're claiming they have, which, you know, is probably a lot less than what they're claiming. If you're able to do that, that's kind of game over for them. That is all the leverage they have. And if they're right now breaking the ceasefire by sending out drone strikes, and then we're able to quickly degrade whatever attacks that they're trying to make, if we can do that and not follow up with sending in men and women and putting our own troops in jeopardy, we are really just trying to figure out the Strait of Hormuz. And that to me, I think, is the answer to all of this. If Trump can figure that out, that takes away not just one of their cards. I would say right now their only card. Their Navy has been degraded by 90%. Even yesterday, there was a story about six ships, and it was like we handled them very quickly. And without, I'm sure there was a lot of effort put into it, but there wasn't as much hoopla as there would have been had this Navy been what it once was, which was very strong and very powerful, and now it's it's a whole different story. So I just think, and there's a million examples of this, but I think that what Trump is trying to do here is find a way, and like he said, it would be a humanitarian success as well, find a way for the world to get access to this waterway, to be able to use this waterway without Iran interfering, and then just watch them hit their point of collapse. Just slowly watch them suffocate without this leverage. That's what I think is happening here. And maybe Marco Rubio will shed even more light on it. But we'll talk about this. We'll take your calls. And it's going to be a really great show. I've got a lot prepared for you here. So stay with us, and we will be right back.
Watch the show live. Rumble.com/The Grace Curley Show. This is The Grace Curley Show.
Today's poll question is brought to you by Perfect Smiles. Don't be fooled by imposters with similar names. If you're unhappy with your smile, you need to visit Dr. Tam in Nashua. Call 1-844-PERFECT-SMILE or visit PerfectSmiles.com. Taylor, what is the poll question and what are the results thus far?
Today's poll question, which you can vote in at GraceCurleyShow.com, is who are you most looking forward to seeing at the press secretary podium? J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, or Donald Trump?
Marco Rubio. I've become a big fan of Marco Rubio. I am happy, though, Taylor, or I'm excited to see kind of the juxtaposition of how Vance and Rubio handle this. I do wonder if this is Trump's kind of way. This is an audition process in some ways. It's like, let's see who can offer up a better beatdown of the mainstream media. But I'm going to go Rubio on this.
I think the results might surprise you. They surprised me. 42% say Marco Rubio. 42% say Donald Trump, and 16% say J.D. Vance.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it's always fun to see Trump at the podium.
I mean, not for me.
I know. You have to cut it, though. You have to cut the sound.
No, I just get, what is this guy going to say? He keeps me on the edge of my seat, and not in a good way. I'm just waiting for a shoe to drop, and it's...
I don't know, though. Hasn't that lessened over time a little bit, Taylor? It has
for
me. Like
I've gotten
to...
so used to it, but it's just like Shane Gillis says it. I'm gonna have to defend this one at work tomorrow, but I'm gonna.
I get more nervous, honestly, about defending, and I don't feel anymore like I have to, and that's taken a lot of weight off me. But I get more nervous about things he's putting out on social media versus what he says. I find that in person, he's actually a lot. He can be a lot more measured than he comes off on social media. And I will say that the first term of Trump, and I remember specifically during COVID being so nervous every time he would do these press conferences, because it would always end up, he would say something and the left would cling to it as the reason why he should not be reelected and blah, 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 blah. And he wants to inject Lysol into he wants you to ingest bleach. And there was all this fake news that would come out. I do think at this point, though, he's done this kind of amazing thing of he's inundated us with so many different, not scandals, but like headline news that there's no way to keep up. Like anything he says has the shelf life of 10 minutes because the next thing is going to be crazier. And once you hit so many topics all the time and you outrage all the people that can be outraged, you do kind of plateau. You know, it's kind of like what, short of him, I don't even know what he could say at this point, Taylor, that would shock me. After the Rob Reiner True Social, I was like, there is nothing this guy can come out with that is going to surprise me at this point. That was the last time he's ever surprised me, and I think it will be the last time ever because of just how insane that was. So, yeah, the only thing about Trump, though, is... You know, the expression, brevity is the soul of wit. He doesn't abide by that. He's not brief. And I think Marco Rubio would keep it within some time constraints, which I would appreciate. We'll be back. We're talking to Francis Martel about Iran. Stay with us.
The Grace Curley Show is on the air.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Grace Curley Show. Joining me now is Francis Martel, Breitbart News' international editor. Francis, thank you so much for coming on the show. I want to start with the press conference today from Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. He was not only affirming that the ceasefire is still in place and continues, but also pushing back on suggestions that perhaps the mission is not being accomplished or the mission is not clear when it comes to this Iranian conflict. Give us your reaction to where we are at right now in this war in Iran.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I think we're in a difficult place with defining a long-term solution to this because the White House's goal is extremely ambitious. President Trump has said it multiple times. He's not ending this conflict until he is absolutely certain that Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. That's a really high bar, right? But the people on the left and detractors who are trying to describe this as some sort of Afghanistan or Iraq type situation where there's no clear goal, I think that's really misleading. The goal is very clear. The goal is Iran can no longer be the premier state sponsor of terrorism in the world, and they cannot under any circumstances be in a position to build a nuclear weapon. That's been very clearly detailed. And so we've gotten pretty far where, you know, between us and Israel, we've essentially dismantled the structure of the top of the regime, right? We've killed dozens of their leaders. It's not even clear who's running things. But that last point, the success in eliminating these leaders makes it really hard to cut a deal because it's not even clear who exactly is in charge. There's this huge Game of Thrones situation within the regime, and that's where the big delay is coming in.
Yeah, and I also want to talk about some of the conflicting information that we get in regards to this blockade. Now, obviously, I tend to go based off CENTCOM. I know that there are some senators right now in the United States who would prefer to listen to Iranian propaganda, but there is a level of confusion in the fog of war about what's actually happening. So we'll get one report that the blockade has been broken, and then we get a report from CENTCOM that, no, we actually took out or turned around six ships, and really without a lot of difficulty, considering the fact that the Iranian Navy has now been degraded by about 90%. So talk to me about this blockade, the strength of it, and where you see this leading to. Is this a solution? Is Trump's idea that I'm going to open up the Strait of Hormuz as a humanitarian aid to the rest of the world, is that feasible, or is this just another part of his negotiation?
I think it's part of, I don't want to say a stall tactic exactly, but the economic side of this for Iran is really, really bad. And I think time is actually on our side of this debate.
Interesting.
As much as I think time is hurting both sides, right? Because the longer this goes on, the worse it's going to be for the midterm elections. You know, approval ratings go down, gas prices go up, the American middle class is hit. But on the other side, it's an existential crisis, right? Like, there's no worst case scenario where America's constitution just stops existing and our regime just collapses entirely. That is what Iran is facing. Their current government structure just completely collapsing, society economically collapsing. And so we're approaching both of those things together. Like, both sides are losing to time, but our worst case is what? Like, the Democrats win a bunch of a bunch of seats in the midterms, and theirs is like the entire Iranian revolution that they put together, this terror regime of the past 50 years will no longer exist. And so I think that's what's going on here. Regarding the strait and the blockades, so there's these two dueling blockades, right? We are blocking the Iranian commerce, again, to push Iran to the brink and to make them see, like, this is existential. You either cut a deal or your regime no longer exists. And then there's the Iranians trying to create this blockade of everybody else where, you know, we believe they shot at a South Korean ship yesterday. They're trying to scare away everybody else's commerce in order for the world to put pressure on the United States. The Iranian efforts are not, they're not 0% effective, but obviously countries like South Korea, like China, are in a really bad state because of this, because they have to get their fuel through there. But they're still doing better than Iran's doing because Iran has to sell their oil. Iran has to generate some sort of money. The protests that we saw in December that resulted in the thousands of people killed in Iran were because of the economy, were because inflation was out of control. You know, nobody could really sustain their households with the economy as it is. Young people have no job prospects. That's only going to be getting worse.
Yeah, and Francis, there's so much there that you just said that I think is so vital for people to hear. But one of the things I also, and I want to come back to the information that we're getting about what's going on with the IRGC, because I think that our media tends to paint things a lot rosier for them than the reality on the ground. But the other part of this that I would like your spin on is the oil situation. So when it gets backed up there, when it's not moving, when they have these key oil facilities and things like Karg Island that are just now becoming run down and weighed down with all of this oil that's going nowhere, what does that do? Like, break down that chain for me as far as the impact that has and the pressure that puts on the IRGC.
Well, when the production lines stop, when the money stops coming in, you know, Iran invests more heavily in the IRGC and in its terror proxies and in the military terror infrastructure than in anything else, right? Like, that money's not going to schools, that money's not going to hospitals, that money's going to the IRGC. And so they're the first ones hit when that money isn't gone through. And then there's the other aspect of this that you brought up that I think is super interesting, which is maintenance, right? If nothing's moving, then nobody's working to maintain these facilities. And this is something that we saw in Venezuela, right? Venezuela has, you know, world's largest oil reserves except for us, these massive profits for most of its history. And then socialism happens and they just stop using a bunch of their refineries, and you get an environmental disaster. We've seen oil spills. We've seen, you know, all sorts of toxic chemicals, petrochemicals that are flying around. You get gangs that start trying to control the territory where the refineries are. And if they run out of money and they want to turn the facilities on again, they don't have the engineers to do it anymore. And Venezuela actually ended up getting Iranian engineers in a couple of years ago to try to fix their facilities. So if Venezuela calls on Iran, who's Iran going to call on to fix their stuff, even if this is resolved today, right? There's still going to be some sort of level of damage that needs to be repaired that is from the lack of use.
Yeah, the other part of this scenario, or this current situation, I should say, that we're watching is the internet blackouts that have been plaguing the Iranian people who are trying to rise up against this regime. And actually, Trump hinted, and there's a lot of stories coming out about this now, because yesterday was the first time that he hinted at perhaps arming the Iranian people. And that's a huge factor here, Francis. We've talked about it before with you on this program about how much of a desire is there to have regime change, because Trump has made it clear that, hey, we're setting the table here, but you guys are going to have to sit down and actually do the job. We're not going to be the ones to do it for you. Now, I want to point out that 45,000 people were willing to go out and be killed in order to stand up against this regime. So I want to point out the extreme courage and bravery and sacrifice that the Iranian people have made to see change. But because of the lack of information that we're getting from the Iranian people, because of these internet blackouts, and because of, and I'm just going to say it, the lack of curiosity or journalism that we have here in the U.S. to tell those people's stories, when instead it's more enticing for them to put out propaganda from the mullahs, it's hard to know what's going on and how close they are to rising up against the IRGC. Do you have any information about that you can share with us?
Well, not much, to be honest, because of those blackouts, because of that lack of information. But what we know about, you know, in recent history, right, in the past few years, what we've seen in Iran, there's near universal rejection of that regime, to the point where there have been protests where young Iranians have, like, waved the Israeli flag as an act of defiance. Like, they really do not like their regime. And the big problem there with overthrowing the regime is that the youth have no weapons and they have no organization. There are some organizations on the ground, like the the National Council of Resistance of Iran has some, you know, people on the ground. They're organizing in Mecca and all of that. But there's no leadership that I think is universally, you know, in charge. And there's definitely no use of force leadership, right? Like, we finally got regime change in Syria, for example, because Ahmed al-Shara was a commanding leader that had an army, and his army was better than the army of the dictator. There's nothing like that in Iran. And this is basically the problem for every oppressed people on earth, right? The Uyghurs don't have an army. The Cubans don't have an army, right? Venezuela didn't have an army until our army came in January. So without that, I mean, even if you did give them guns, who's the general that's going to turn, like, prevent that from turning into just rampant gang warfare? So that's my concern with that plan. If there's no serious leadership on the ground, a respected leader that could be the next head of state, that is in Iran and respected by Iranians, not the Shah, alleged Shah, not the lady in Germany, like someone actually in Iran. Without that, it's really, really difficult to take over a country. And really, Syria is the only example I could think of in modern history where it actually happened, because you had a guy who was on the ground with guns and an army, and not just, you know, 90% of the country wants change, but no one's actually organizing anything.
Yeah, and the last topic that I would like to hit on today, Francis, has to do with China. So Trump's summit with Xi Jinping is set for mid-May. And today, and you've reported on this at Breitbart, the Chinese foreign ministry confirmed that the Iranian foreign minister is flying to Beijing. I don't know if he's already arrived, for a meeting upon invitation with his Chinese counterpart. So that would be the Chinese foreign minister. What do you think is going to come out of this, like, explain the dynamics here and also the closeness and proximity to this meeting that they're set to have with Trump between Xi Jinping and Trump? Does this meeting that we now know is taking place between the Chinese foreign minister and the Iranian foreign minister, is that going to have an effect on what we see in mid-May?
I think it will, and I think the Iranians are preempting a campaign by Trump. I think Trump's going to go to China and tell Xi Jinping, your alliance with Iran does not benefit China. They are not good friends to you. It does not help you in any way to be associated with these jihadists that have nothing to do with, you know, what the Chinese Communist Party stands for. You can make more money just doing deals with us, and, you know, finding ways to work with Saudi Arabia, with UAE, with Qatar, than you are by being friends with Iran. I think that's what Trump's going to argue. And I think the Iranians think that Trump's going to argue that. And that's why they're trying to preempt the visit and go over there in person and make their case for why they deserve Chinese support. The Chinese have already expressed a lot of public frustration with Iran. Xi Jinping himself, in a phone call with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, said, we need the Strait of Hormuz open. And it was very notable that he did not, you know, usually they'll say, you know, we need obvious good thing, and it's America's fault that we don't have obvious good thing. The lack of blame on America suggests that China knows that Iran is the problem, and they're broadcasting to the world that China knows that Iran is the problem. So I think that's what this is all about.
And I'm going to be greedy here and ask actually one more. So we talked earlier about the Strait of Hormuz, but the Project Freedom, as they're calling it, and as we heard Secretary of War Pete Hegseth talk about today, talk to me a little bit, if you would, Francis, about what that is going to look like. Like, I because to me, as someone who's not an expert on this waterway at all, When we learn about all the incredible things our military is able to do and just all that we've accomplished in this short span of time, to me, it does feel like, well, why can't we just get this thing open and make sure we've already degraded their Navy by 90%. Why can't we just open it, leave them out of it and take over? But how complicated is it? I know it's more complicated than my brain is telling me, but how complicated and how big of an ask is this?
So I think in terms of the technical aspects of, if we just wanted to open the strait and then just destroy Iran if they tried to defy us, I think we could do it. But I think what the White House is doing is looking at this as more of a chess game, gaming out, you know, what happens if X does Y and then Y does this. And so let's say we, you know, put all our soldiers in there, all our sailors, open it up, and Iran decides to bomb us and then kills an American soldier or, you know, damages some American asset, we're going to have to essentially obliterate the rest of the regime. And that's what Trump has said, right? If
right.
Iran takes any moves that actively, you know, if a soldier dies, it's over for Iran. And I think Trump would have to follow through on that. If he follows through on that, Iran, which is a country of 90 million people, is going to be the next Libya. We've already done a situation, right, where we've looked at a dictatorship that's harmful to us, a terror state, and we've taken out the dictator, and then we just leave a power vacuum. And that's what Libya is. And Libya is an unmitigated disaster. So we don't want to do that. And so that's why Project Freedom is so surgical. They're looking at the ships that they can help. They're picking out the ships that they think are essentially the safest to take out of there. So, for example, we helped a ship that belonged to Maersk, which is one of the biggest shipping companies in the world. There was no problem because Iran knows, the Iranians know that if they touch that ship and they touch our military, it's game over for them. So I think it's just about picking targets that they know are too high stakes for the Iranians to attack, and not letting this get to a situation where Iran is completely ungoverned.
Well said. Frances Martell, we thank you so much. Tell people where they can follow you on social media. I know they can go to Breitbart.com to read your stuff, but what's your Twitter handle?
Thank you so much. I'm at Frances Martell, Frances with an E. And yeah, that's where I'm most active. So
awesome. I appreciate it so much. When we come back, I'm going to play actually a couple more sound cuts from Rich Goldberg, who was on Fox today, and echoing a little bit of what Frances just said, but I think breaking down this Project Freedom in a way that we can all wrap our heads around. So we will finish off the hour with Iran when we come back.
More of The Grace Curley Show up next. This is The Grace Curley Show.
The live auction for Karen Reed's SUV is happening at Manzi Appraisers in Woburn, Mass. On Thursday, May 14th from 2 to 5. It's a remote show for Howie Carr, so make sure you check it out. Again, that's Thursday, May 14th from 2 to 5 in Woburn, Mass. Karen Reed's SUV up for auction. You are not going to want to miss that. That's going to be a fun show. I wanted to talk a little bit more here about Iran, and we will end up taking this, I think, at 1:30 as well. This 21-mile-wide choke point, the Strait of Hormuz, is the only leverage, as far as I can see right now, that Iran has. They've got a fractured IRGC, as Frances Martell pointed out. They have an economy that is on the brink of collapse. They have degraded capabilities. And I want to read you this quote here. This is from Admiral Cooper. He was on a conference call yesterday with the media. He said, I'll give you just an example. Just from this morning, in my own experience, I've transited through the Strait of Hormuz probably 100 times in my career. You typically see between 20 and 40 small boats in the pack coming out. Today, we saw 6 and eliminated them quickly. I think this is an example of the degradation of their capability. It doesn't mean it's all gone, but it's highly degraded. And like I said, over 90% of the Navy has been sunk. Now, this is not me saying the war is over, the conflict is over, or trying to pitch you guys on all the successes, but more so saying that the longer we can keep this ceasefire, as the longer we can avoid escalating the confrontation back into combat territory and figure out, buy ourselves time to figure out how to open the Strait of Hormuz to drive the price of oil down and provide this protection for maritime trade, I think we're just going to watch this regime suffocate. And I don't think we're hearing the half of how bad things are for the IRGC, certainly not from our media here. We'll continue to talk. We got Ed Flynn, city councilor, coming up next.